like hot sauce? Then you'll love Great White Hot Sauce. It's a small batch, handmade hot sauce, made especially for you. So if you want some badass hot sauce, go to www.trygreatwhite.com. Well, here we are. Episode 82. And on this episode, Jack and I aren't going to talk about the top three greatest frontmen of all time. I think we all know who they are. And number three is up for debate, but either way, close enough. We're going to talk about numbers 4 through 9, or who we think are numbers 4 through 9. Oh, I'm guaranteeing an argument. Maybe 5 arguments. We'll see. It's normal anyways. And we're going to talk about some music news. Metallica is at it again with ticket pricing. Assholes. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the podcast.
The KOFB studio presents Milk Crates and Turntables, a music discussion podcast hosted by Scott McLean with his co-host Jack Calabrese. Now, let's talk music. Enjoy the show.
Thank you, Amanda, for that wonderful introduction, as usual. Let me adjust some audio stuff here. Welcome to the podcast. You know the name. I'm not going to say it. We're streaming live right now over Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, DLive, a couple other places. But it's all about the podcast platforms. That's what matters most to me. Doing it live is just fun. You know it's not fun? When your co-host decides to come on 1 minute before the show starts. Yay! Let's even see if his audio works. Hi, Jack.
I had to make my tea.
All right, I'm going to quote you last week. What a pussy. You pussy.
First off, I don't sound like that at all.
Okay? Yeah, I'm telling you, I mimic you perfectly.
Okay. Got a nice little cup of tea to, you know, kind of make sure that my voice is all warmed up. Got a little honey in there, you know. Just got to make sure that I sound good for all the three folks that are out there.
Why do you care? You don't listen.
I don't have to listen. Listen. When Bono finishes a show. Do you think he goes back and listens to the concert that he just did? He was there. He experienced it. He doesn't have to listen. I know what I said. I know what I'm going to say now. Inconceivable.
But that's not your reason for not listening. I don't want to hear my own voice. I don't think I sound good, so it doesn't matter with the T.
Dude, you're coming out swinging tonight, huh?
I'm all jacked up.
How come?
I just had some Bustelo. I shouldn't drink that at 7:30. Bustelo is some really strong coffee. I don't know. I was just doing shit all day. I was a little tired. Dave Phillips, friend of the show. Welcome. Yeah, I had had
Davey Phillips.
I don't know. Did I have the comments fixed last week or no?
I don't think you did.
No, I figured out what was going wrong. We weren't getting any comments displayed. And so, you know, it's always something when you're live streaming. I've learned that over the last 2 years. Nothing is 100%. They're like dogs. You're very active tonight, Jack.
I'm just, you know what?
Very movie aroundy.
The lighting was making me look very pale. Well, now I look like I'm in the dark.
Maybe if you didn't come on fucking 1 minute before I went live, then you'd have this stuff set up. Like a true professional would.
It's been a very busy evening. I had an art lesson before this.
Yeah, well, I'm very proud of you. That's fucking fantastic. I've taken on
a mentor. So
you're teaching somebody how to paint. Is that what you're saying?
No, I've taken on a mentor. I'm the mentee.
Oh, what is this? A Seinfeld episode? I have a mentor.
I have a mentor.
All right.
So prior to our broadcast, I've been on the phone with somebody from the Midwest that has been tearing apart my artwork in a constructive way and has given me some direction to try to take things to the next level.
Good.
Yeah.
That is your passion.
Oh, it's healthy, you know?
Yeah. No, that's your passion.
Hey.
The sipping over the microphone. Dude, is this the Curb Your Enthusiasm episode? You didn't go afterwards.
Look, I know it's not music related, but did you see that Christy Alley died? Was it yesterday?
Dude, I was doing my live stream.
Last week, Christy McVie. Yeah. This week, Christy Alley. You got to figure that Christy Brinkley and Christy McNichol must be shitting their pants right now. Things always happen in threes.
I was doing a live stream when my live stream partner mentioned that it broke in. Like, oh, I don't know if you've ever seen it. And if you're listening out there, if you've ever seen it, you'll know what I'm talking about. But Christy Alley did a show called Fat Actress. And it was fucking hilarious. Dude, it was fucking hilarious. That woman, when she was on, man. And it was basically one of those kind of Curb Your Enthusiasm, like a camera follows her around type thing. And she was at her big, she was a big girl at that time. So she decided to do a show to mock herself pretty much in the life of a fat actress. Dude, if you can ever find it, that shit was fucking funny.
She was a funny lady.
Comedy gold, man. Yeah.
She was a funny lady.
Yeah, yeah.
71, you know, look, when you and I were, I was 15 and you were 19 or whatever it is, our age difference. 71's ancient. But now where we are in our lives, you're like, oh my God, she was so young. So young.
I'll be 59 next week.
Woo, baby.
You know what? I'm a bad motherfucking 59. I'll tell you that. That I know. I ain't the old guy used to be 59 guy. No.
I'm just hoping at some point your self-confidence kicks in. Break out of your shell a little bit.
I'm a bad motherfucking 59. I will brag about that.
59. I feel fine.
I could still be a fucking hitman if I wanted to be.
Hey, you know what? You just mentioned that your birthday is next week. How about today's birthday, boy?
I'll get to that. You might not be on the show at the time, but one of my
musical heroes, Tom Waits. Yep,
Tom Waits. You probably won't be on the show. Dave Sillis says I have underwear older than you. Well, that's good. You are a fucking mess. What?
Ugh.
You're fucking sneezing. You're sipping fucking tea. You're getting up. You're moving around.
It makes the show real. It's not so polished.
No. I like polished. Polished is stop the fucking slurping. You fucking asshole. You know I can't reach you. That's why you do it. I can't reach you. All right, there you go. Now you got them. You made the noise. There you go.
So before we leave him, and I know you said that you're going to talk about him later, but I may not be on the show. I mean, yeah, you're not really a big Tom Waits fan, are you?
Well, I don't dislike him. I like him. I do like him. Oh, Mark Smith, I will fucking choke you. You don't fucking give him ideas. Mark Smith says, I want to see Jack slurp and play that guitar. The net. Oh, buddy. You, Mark Smith's supposed to be the nice guy. Now I see. Fucking sabotage. No, I do not dislike Tom Waits. I like Tom Waits. I'm not a fan like you are, but I like his style. I never had any problem with it. Did you know? Interesting story that's involved.
Is it a story? Is it a Tom Waits story? Are you gonna quiz me? Put it in the form of a question. Let's see if I know it.
Tom Waits did an interview in Australia, okay, back in probably, I think it was probably the late 70s, we'll say, right? Maybe early 80s, somewhere around that time. He did, it became kind of a infamous interview with him. And he was kind of ornery in his own way, but that interview inspired what movie role, what actor to what actor was inspired by that interview and became an infamous character in the movies? Do you understand the question? It's kind of a on the spot thing, but you get what I'm saying, right?
I think I do.
So Tom Waits was the influence in that, from that specific interview.
Yeah.
Was the influence to this infamous movie character. The actor used Tom Waits as a this is how I'm gonna do this character.
No idea.
Heath Ledger, the Joker.
That's pretty good.
Right? Right? So if you listen to him do the Joker, now you'll hear it a little differently. I'll send you the video of that interview. He was fucking ornery, but in his own way. Like, he was younger. He was a little more brash. He's, you know, it's a great interview. And the interviewer handles him really well, considering he was throwing him off his game. He was throwing the interviewer off his game.
Tom Waits is an interesting interviewer, interesting raconteur, storyteller. Even on his some of his albums, there's some spoken word things that are pretty entertaining. Even his live album. So in the late 80s, he put out a live record called Big Time. And in it, leading into one of the songs, he said, okay. He was like, you know, the question that's asked to me, the question that's asked most often, and enough that I would mention it, is, Tom, can a woman get pregnant without actual intercourse? And my answer is always the same. I say, look, we're going to have to go way back to the Civil War. Apparently, a stray bullet pierced the testicle of a Union soldier and lodged itself in the ovaries of an 18-year-old girl that was 100 yards from him. She was fine. The baby was healthy, and she was very happy. Of course, the soldier's a little pissed off. I guess that's some form of intercourse, but not for everyone. Maybe for those who love action. He always had goofy little stories like that. I always loved that stuff that he did.
Interesting Tom character. Waits. Definitely interesting character. And very unique.
Well, you know what's interesting? Over the past couple of episodes that we've been on, you've kind of picked on Carly Simon and her not being worthy or deserving to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And one of the stats, not saying that it's the only one, but one of the stats that you used is that through her long career, she's only managed to sell 9,500 albums or so. Yeah. Tom Waits has probably put out three times as many albums as her and has sold about 4.5 million. You know, definitely a niche acquired taste. You know, not everybody digs him. The voice, the gravelly, you know, some of his music is dark. Some of his music is based on vaudeville, jazz and blues. He's a different kind of guy. But yeah, the Calabrese household, loves him. And there's been a longstanding debate who introduced the Calabrese family to Tom Waits. Deb thinks it's her. Jack thinks it's he.
Like they didn't know about Tom Waits before Deb came along? Are you talking your children?
Well, our children have grown up, but both of my kids love Tom Waits because they've grown up listening to Tom Waits for the past, you know, 20 years.
So what part
years.
Of the Calabrese family, your family or your you and your children, that Calabrese family?
Basically into our circle. She thinks that she introduced me to Tom Waits.
Oh, okay. Well.
And what I tell her is that I've knew about Tom Waits, knew some of his stuff, but she definitely was the one that got me into Tom Waits, like got me really listening and understanding his music. And just as a side note, before we leave him, you know, I know that you and I, we speak a lot about concerts that we've been to, and Tom Waits is definitely in my top five concerts of all time. And one of the reasons is, you know, first and foremost, he doesn't tour very often. As a matter of fact, the last full-scale tour that he's done in the United States was back in 2007. I happened to get to see the last show that he did in Atlanta and happened to get to go to that with my father, who I turned on to Tom Waits.
Okay. That sounds like a bonding moment.
It was fantastic. Although at one point I was like, Dad, sorry, I got to go. And ran down the aisle and snuck into the front row for a little while.
So Tom Waits is not a front man. He is a solo artist, right? So our topic tonight is best front men. And some people are like, well, they're singers. I don't consider solo artists frontmen. I consider them solo artists, right? What's your take on that?
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting that you say that. Deborah, the lovely Deborah, and I were driving last night. We had a little bit of a trek, and we had this very conversation. You know, what constitutes a frontman? And one of the people that she brought up was Kurt Cobain a frontman?
Yeah.
And I was like, he is. I was like, but in my mind, I don't think there's a clear definition to what a front man is. But when I think of front man, I think of lead singer, not playing guitar, not standing behind an instrument, somebody that's working the stage with a microphone that is leading a band. I understand that is a narrow description. It may not be entirely accurate. Based upon how somebody else might look at it. It's just the way that I think of a front man. I think of a front man, I think of David Lee Roth. I don't think of, you know, I don't think of Kurt Cobain. I don't think of, you know, so, you know, like the discussion that Deb and I had, you know, I was like, well, you know, he's the singer in the band. And he's the principal song. He's definitely the leader of the band. I was like, but I don't look at it that the same way in terms of frontman. You know, it was like you could make the same argument. It was John Lennon a frontman in the Beatles?
No, because they had two singers. Technically three.
No, they did not. But they had four singers.
I'm saying technically three. Four wasn't really that was a throw-in. I mean, Ringo's a throw-in.
Yeah.
But they had, you know, they split time. So I wouldn't say Lennon was a frontman. Would you say Stevie Ray Vaughan is a front man?
I can see it both ways.
Is Jimi Hendrix a front man? Right.
I can see it both ways. But the my description, like when you and I first talked about, you know, who's the best front man in rock and roll, my classic vision of what a front man is somebody that is standing out working the stage with a microphone.
Right. And you won't get an argument from me. I'm of the same mindset that a front man can play guitar, but if he's a guitar player, he's a part of the band, right?
Yeah.
He's the lead singer of a band, but he's not the front man of a band. I see what you're saying, and I think other people might think otherwise, but I'm kind of with you on that. My brother asked me about, I talked to my brother Colin today about this. We had a pretty good conversation. He brought up some good points. Was Prince a front man? All right. You got to think about it, right? You have to think about that.
Well, you know, sometimes Prince was just on the microphone, so he kind of fits that bill. But to your point, you know, Prince is a solo artist.
Well, he was with, he had his band when he first, you know, after he did his first album, he had his band. The band that did 1999 was the last album they did together. Then they moved on to the Revolution. Then he moved on to the New Power Generation, right? And so he had a band behind him, and he didn't always play the guitar. He didn't always play the piano. Whenever he was playing, that he plays everything. So is Prince a front man? You know what I mean? Like, his bands were announced who they were: Prince and the Revolution, Prince and the New Power Generation, right?
Yeah,
so I mean, it's an interesting question. It's an interesting question.
Well, you know what? You'll get no argument out of me if you say Kurt Cobain's a front man, Sting is a front man, Prince is a front man, Stevie Ray Vaughan is a front man. You know, Eric Clapton was a front man.
But we're going next level front man. We're going to talk next level front man. The, like you are, the pure front man. That is their job. That is their job, to be the front man, the lead singer. And they pick up an instrument every once in a while, but your primary job as a front man is to carry the show.
Yep.
Like, you have to be center stage. You have to be like, okay, Dave Phillips said, and why we're doing 4 to 9, our original conversation between Jack and I was top 5. And I was thinking about it today, and I said, well, we already know those things. Like, we know 1, 2, and 3. And I don't care who you are, you can mix and match them and you'll get no argument. So I say the top 3 would be Mick Jagger, Freddie Mercury, and Steven Tyler. Right? I would say they are. Number 4 would be Robert Plant. Right? Do you agree?
I would agree. The only thing that I will differ from what you're saying is, there's no question in my mind that there's one person that belongs in that number one spot, and that's Mick Jagger.
I agree. My brother and I had that conversation also. Yes,
Mick Jagger. You know, look, Freddie Mercury was a tremendous, tremendous frontman, and could, you know, capture an audience and hold it in his hand for as long as he wanted. But Mick Jagger invented the fucking position. Let's be honest.
So, listen, I'm with you on this. I say Freddie Mercury was more theater. He was more theater than most frontmen. He came out with the big cape. He had the microphone that was like a scepter. He had the crown, you know, the whole thing. And he marched around, and he just basically commandeered the stage, but he was very theatrical. Mick Jagger, on the other hand, was fucking pure. Those moves, that dancing, the head jerks, the chicken walk, you know, just that was all pure energy. And Mick Jagger just carried that. He was mesmerizing watching him. You couldn't, like, he just was so unique. He's glitchy, you know, he's herky, he's jerky, but his voice and his style, and he was dancing around, but he wasn't a pussy. Like, you're like, dude, Mick Jagger's fucking just cool.
Yeah. You know? And Mick Jagger, you know, I wholeheartedly agree, you know, high energy and whatnot. And part of it is inspiration. And there are plenty of articles, you know, videos and documentaries and that type of thing that, you know, part of Mick Jagger's, you know, persona and his stage present was inspired. And it was inspired by a lot of the black artists out there. James Brown, right. Tina Turner.
Yeah.
You know, you look at you look at the videos of the Rolling Stones back in the day before they had Ike and Tina Turner open for them. And look at the Rolling Stones.
Yeah,
after.
Right. Oh, I was going to mention that. Yeah. He was very tame. He would move a little, but he wasn't really jumping around. But that's the evolution, right? That's the evolution of a front man.
Of course. Artists leverage things from each other, which is a nice way to say that artists steal from one another.
Like David Bowie stole from Iggy Pop and Lou Reed. You know, he was very good at that. Bowie was very good at picking out certain aspects of an artist and incorporating it into his persona, in his act. And that's fine. That's fine, because he wasn't exactly like them. They influenced him, you know? And listen, fucking rock stars. Iggy Pop and fucking and Lou Reed are just pure rock stars.
Yeah, no question.
And Bowie wanted to be a rock star. They carried themselves like rock stars. They acted like rock stars. You know, they didn't give a fuck like rock stars. They were rock stars.
But you know what? While you're on the subject, I mean, we should not discount or leave behind the influence, the frontman influence that was Iggy Pop.
Well, I have him on my list. So
as you should.
We'll get to that. Yep. So Dave Phillips says, don't discount Peter Wolf. You know what? Peter, I know you're a big fan, Dave. Dave Phillips is a big advocate of Jay Giles. He wants them to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's a huge Jay Giles fan. But Peter Wolf was, I'm just going to say it, buddy. Dave Phillips, I love you. The king of the 45s, my friend, but I'm going to say it. Peter Wolf is a second-rate Steven Tyler. I'm sorry I said it. I know.
I think that's absolute bullshit.
I'm just saying, I think he's a second-rate Steven Tyler. He can move around, and he danced around, and he did his thing.
No. Peter Wolf and Steven Tyler are two different entities.
And, of course they are, but
Peter Wolf has his own thing.
Yeah,
I would venture to say that Peter Wolf was more influenced by all of the old soul bands that he was influenced by back in the day, far more than watching Steven Tyler. Steven Tyler is an amazing, amazing front man, but I think you're way off fucking base there. Well, I know you're not.
All right, let me talk. I'm getting attacked by the Jay Giles fans because Mark Friedman is another one who just messaged Wolf and his day were far better. They're both big Jay Giles fans. So,
is Mark and Dave Phillips, are they from the Northeast?
Yeah. Yeah, I believe they are. Yeah. I know. Yeah,
so, I know. You know what? Look, yeah. Mark and Dave have to realize, and Scott, you may have a broader perspective about this, but like we in the Northeast think that the Jay Giles band is this huge, huge band.
I came to not find everywhere. Out they weren't. Yeah.
Not everywhere.
I came to find out.
They were a popular band, no question about it, but they didn't have the presence and the popularity that they did in the Northeast.
As I traveled the country,
yeah,
I found, as you did, I found, you know, in the military that Jay Giles is not a popular band outside of New England. They're known because of Centerfold, right? But you didn't hear people playing that shit in their cars.
No, look, like in the Northeast, in Boston in particular, we hold the Jay Giles band up like, you know, with Aerosmith and with, bands like, you know, Bad Company or you know what the reality of it is when you go to Arizona, you know, the Jay Giles band is probably more in the catalog, in the category of Molly Hatchet or a Foghat. We know who they are.
Yeah, you know who they are. But name a song other than Centerfold. I'm not asking you. I'm not asking you that. Yeah, yeah. I'm asking the people in Arizona, you know, and the people in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Sacramento, California, Riverside, California, all over. LA, ask them to name another song other than Centerfold. It says, did you ever see Jay Giles Band live? I personally never saw them. I was not a big... What?
You never saw the Giles Band?
No.
So here's a homework assignment for you. You know, since you're blabbing Wait. Just shut up for a second before I fly down
you
there and
shut
smack
up.
You right in
Jesus.
The 59-year-old.
Fucking bold.
Come on, let's
just
go.
Getting bold, yeah. Jack puts up the Dukes like a fucking, like a 79-year-old guy. Puts up the Dukes, the backs of his hands showing first. Like
come on, Sonny boy. Time
snaps
to teach you
his
a
wrist
lesson.
Forward.
I don't know how you can sit on your side of the world and say that Peter Wolf basically is a poor man Steven Tyler if you've never seen them live. So here's your homework assignment. You should go on to YouTube and watch some old Giles Band live, and you'll see that Peter
Do
Wolf
you
was
fucking
a dynamic.
Think that I live in a fucking box that I've never seen videos. I've never heard Jay Giles live. I never saw videos of Jay Giles live. You think I'd like this?
I don't know if you have. I don't know.
I'm telling you I have. Why wouldn't I have? I just never saw them live. Like, I didn't go to the concert. But I've seen concert footage.
Not enough synth for you.
I've seen Peter Wolf eat a fucking banana sitting right next to me, okay? Top that, Dave Phillips and Mark Friedman.
Did he eat it just like Steven Tyler?
He ate it. Fucking eating a banana at a concert in a fucking the Fabulous Thunderbirds. I'm sitting
yeah,
next to him on the side of the stage, and he pulls a fucking banana out and just starts eating.
But that was back in the old garden, right?
Let me see. Somebody, Olympic 65 says, at the old Boston guys, yeah. Not so
yeah,
much
so,
at the
so
Jay Giles, but
you know,
enjoyed
you know
seeing
why?
Peter Wolf's roots. I'm talking here. Seeing Peter Wolf's Roots Bluegrass Band at
a
festival.
You
are just, this is a fucked up show already. Yeah. We're a half hour into it. You got 28 minutes, motherfucker.
Maybe 18.
So he's, this viewer enjoyed seeing Peter Wolf's Roots Bluegrass Band at a festival. See, now that's interesting, right? A lot of people wouldn't know that he has a band like that, right?
He has, When he did a couple of solo albums, and he was trying to find his way, like, you know, in the, you know, the 90s and early 2000s, but he's got a couple of solo albums that are a little bit later. And I think one of them is called Sleepless. It's actually on Rolling Stone's top 500 albums of all time. It is an incredible record, and it doesn't really sound like the Jay Giles Band to, our viewers, you know, post and point. It's more rooted in roots music and blues music and right. You know, folk. It's really good.
Right,
I don't think you give the Giles Band as much credit as they probably deserve, and certainly Peter Wolf is a tremendous okay. front man.
I was being a little harsh on Peter Wolf just to get it. Actually,
so you got beat up here in this.
You know what? I admire the fucking passion. I admire the passion, and that's what I got out of this. Now, Peter Wolf is a good front man. I was kind of jokingly when I said he's a second rate Steven Tyler. I wanted to see what Dave Phillips would say. But
let me ask you this:
he's a very good front. He danced around. He's active. He did what a front man is supposed to do. Entertain the crowd.
So
he was all energy. He was all energy, you know. But yeah. You know,
let me ask you this, just because you drew the comparison. So Peter Wolf, we've established, is not a second rate Steven Tyler, but is Steven Tyler a second rate Mick Jagger?
Mick Jagger, and that was his knock. That was the knock on him for a long time. Was people would say. He's trying to be like Mick Jagger. That shows you how great Mick Jagger was. If you even try to dance like him or act like him, then you were trying to be Mick Jagger. So that's the greatness of Mick Jagger. But Steven Tyler fought through that, just like the Stone Temple Pilots got the label of, you know, like trying to be like Pearl Jam. They're trying to sound like Pearl Jam. It happens. But Steven Tyler and Aerosmith were far too good to let something like that stop him. He was too good. To try to change. That's the way he did things. And he made a name for himself doing that.
I think that Steven Tyler, you know, maybe in the early days he was closer to Mick Jagger, but I thought that Steven Tyler kind of had his own thing. He wasn't the run around the stage manically like Mick Jagger. I thought that Steven Tyler had more style and kind of greasy swagger, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. Jagger, like I said, he's herky jerky, he's twitchy, you know, the chicken walk thing that he would do. And it was just it's like, I never saw them live, but Joy
Division. You never saw it?
No. The lead singer from Joy Division was.
Ian Curtis.
Dude, if they had stuck her, if he had not killed himself, have you ever seen the documentary
on, yeah, very on sad. Joy
Division?
Very
that
sad.
That dude, when he got on stage, he turned into a whole different fucking person. He was mesmerizing to watch. Just on video, I just couldn't take my eyes off him. The way he just stood there and jittered and like convulsed while he was singing. It was fucking amazing. That was like something enters his soul when he gets on stage. Outside of that, he was very like laid back. But Mark Smith says, more accurately, was Tyler and Perry a second-rate Jagger and Richards? See, I've heard that before also.
Yeah. Well, was Rod Stewart and Ronnie Wood second-rate, you know, Jagger and Richards?
No,
you know,
they were all kind of. Rod Stewart is totally different. Totally different.
Well, what I'm saying is those three bands were all kind of rooted in the same thing, right? The old blues and you know, infusing the rock element into it. You know, I know that was always the knock on Aerosmith, especially early, you know, that they were the Americanized version of the Rolling Stones. But yeah. I always thought that they, you know, Aerosmith, they had their own, they didn't sound like the Stones to me.
No, they didn't sound like them.
Have you ever in your life made the mistake, had mistaken no. a Rolling Stones song for an Aerosmith or vice versa?
No, I never mistake Tyler for Jagger, you know?
No.
I think, though, that was the mark that the Rolling Stones left, was anybody that comes close, is they're going to be compared to them. Anything, any like style, they would get compared to them. Yeah. Although Aerosmith was the band that stood out as far as, you know, sounding like the Stones. But so let's get into the list. All right. We have 4 through 9, right? Is that what we did for? So we got six names, right? I'll start off.
So again, yeah. We started Jagger, not in any particular order aside from one. Jagger,
Mercury,
Tyler, Mercury,
and Mercury. Yeah,
and you said Plant, right?
I said Plant. No, but you know that would be number four. So you could say Robert Plant, but I'm going to say somebody that I think was more of a front man than Robert Plant was. And I'll say at number four, I'd have no problem putting Jim Morrison there.
All right. Your number four and my number four are different, but go ahead. Give me your Jim Morrison argument.
The quintessential front man. People went to see the Doors, not to see Ray Manzarek or John Densmore or, you know, or Robbie Krieger. They went to see fucking Jim Morrison.
Of course.
They went to see. Now that is the reason he would be number four in my book. When they went to see Led Zeppelin, you're going to see fucking Bonham. You're going to see Jimmy Page and Robert Plant stand there and sing with that amazing voice and just that charismatic, you know, look that he had. But Jim Morrison, people went to see him. They went to see what he was going to do. And his voice was fucking great. And what he did on stage was purely in the moment most of the time. So I'm going to sidetrack for 1 second. There's certain front men that don't necessarily have to move around to be great front men. Robert Plant is one of them, right? Liam Gallagher of Oasis is another one. That motherfucker is a rock star. He's like one of the last rock stars. he would come out in that fucking parka with the glasses and just put his hands behind his back and kind of lean down into the mic and sing. And just the fucking, the arrogance he carried makes him a great frontman. And he doesn't have to move around a lot.
So
it's just the arrogance that
he
puts up.
Is Liam Gallagher, did you give me your number four and number five? Did you sneak another one in?
No, I'm going off the side. I'm going on a side note. I told you, I'm just going to go off to the side for a second. So you have great frontmen that don't necessarily have to jump around, like you were saying, that move around, command the stage. There's guys that can't stand there and still be great frontmen. That's Robert Plant. Robert Plant didn't fucking do anything. He stood there with a sock in his pants and sang, right? He's not an active guy, right?
And I think you're right. For the most part, Morrison was kind of the, you know, the same way. He wasn't a big work the stage guy. It's not to say that he didn't, but you know, a lot of the times he would plant himself at the mic, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. And I agree with you. I think that Morrison belongs on the list. I'm not sure that I would put him at number four, but that's just my perspective.
Right, right. I agree. Yeah, this is all this is. So who do you think would be?
My number four is pretty clear, and that is Mr. Roger Daltrey of The Who.
I mentioned him to my brother earlier. I actually did. I don't have him on my list, but I have him on like a secondary.
How could you
like
not have Roger Daltrey on your list?
I thought about it. I did. And I am not knocking him. I saw them. I saw him.
Come on. The fringes, the swinging the microphone around. The mic. You know?
Now, remember, though, his frontman status didn't really come about, if you ask Pete Townsend, until Tommy.
Yeah, but wait a minute. You're making it sound like it was a far away.
I'm not making it sound like you're not even letting me fucking finish. You're jumping at something I just started saying.
Scott.
What?
We're never gonna get sponsors if you keep swearing like that.
Did I swear? I don't even realize it sometimes.
I'm gonna put hot sauce on your tongue.
You're the one that told me to shut the fuck up earlier. I think.
I don't benefit by the sponsors.
Neither do I. We don't need the money. Well, you know what? Listen, I will not argue with you. And I will not argue with you. Roger Daltrey, great frontman. I think better than Robert Plant.
But still not on your list.
No, I have a pretty diverse list. You know what? I like my list. I actually like
Dave. Dave Phillips is saying that Pete Townsend sang more lead than Roger. That's bullshit. You don't know what the fuck you're talking about, Dave. Get off of our show.
You tell him, Dave. You tell him, Dave.
It's not
Dave,
true.
You know the phone number, buddy. You know the phone
number. It's not true. But getting back to Roger, as you had so eloquently stated, you're right. Pete Townsend said Roger didn't find his voice until Tommy.
No, Pete Townsend said he was just the singer amongst three geniuses. That's what he said. He was just the singer.
What I read in Pete Townsend's autobiography is that Roger did not really find his voice. He didn't turn into Roger Daltrey until Tommy. But bear in mind that the Who's first release was in like 65. And Tommy was in 69. It wasn't like a decade later. It was a couple of years later.
I didn't say that. You're sounding like aggressive. Like I disputed you.
No.
Does that make sense? Well, I disputed you?
Yes. Thank you. Appreciate that.
No, I wasn't saying. I'm not saying it. I'm just saying I saw an interview with Pete Townsend. He said Roger Daltrey was just the singer amongst three geniuses. He finally got our respect when Tommy came along, basically what you just said, but that's what he said. For those years, he was just the singer. Like,
yeah,
we need him, but we really don't. Like, but Tommy comes along, and then they're like, now you're the fucking lead singer.
Yeah.
Now you got our respect.
Look, they can dismiss him, you know, all that they want, but, you know, the Who isn't the Who without Roger Daltrey.
Okay. I'm not going to argue with you.
All right, you can't argue with me.
My number five is the man we talked about earlier. Iggy Pop. That fucking rock star. Fucking rock star. Look at the inventor of the stage dive, right?
Yes.
The perpetrator of fucking self-mutilation on stage and making it part of the show, right? Because he's so caught up in it. Like, he really didn't want to do it, but he said, I was just so in the moment. I just fucking did it with the fucking bottle, right? And talk about moves and how they move around the stage and that just his glare, those fucking eyes. You know, he can be angry. He can give a good fucking angry face.
Iggy Pop, you know, if there are probably, you know, people out there that don't get into music or waste their time with it as much as we do, you know, that don't realize, you know, they think that punk, you know, happened around, you know, 77, 78, not realizing that, you know, Iggy and the Stooges, I mean, you're talking, you know, way back in the late 60s and early 70s, you know, they were playing that fierce music. And you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a guy that left it all on the stage, cut himself, jumped, rolled in stuff. The one thing that I didn't understand, why did he use to smear peanut butter on himself?
That's...
I don't...
I think he thought it was probably so absurd. It's so absurd.
That it just seems, you know what? Never mind absurd. It just seems dumb.
I don't know. Well, listen, when you're an 18-year-old at a Stooges concert, right? You think it's fucking outrageous. Like, it's just so fucking out there, right? Who knows?
I don't know. It's just, it's goofy.
But it's great. But he made it great, right? Hey, Luke Colicchio's watching. He says, creamy or chunky?
Chunky.
I have a jar of each in my cabinets, by the way.
Well, it wouldn't have been hilarious if, you know, corporate sponsorship of tours. Iggy Pop sponsored by Skippy.
I knew you were going to say Skippy. Yeah, yeah. Is Skippy the first peanut butter that comes to mind, right? Why is that? You know, I'm a Peter Pan guy myself.
That's what we grew up with, right? You know, it was Skippy or
Jif or Peter Pan.
Peter Pan.
Peter Pan is like the stepchild of peanut butter. No one really gets Peter Pan. They get Jif or Skippy.
We don't use like either Peter anymore. Pan. Is that what you use now?
Peter Pan. Yeah, I'm like a 12-year-old.
No, we use the... what is it? It's the not the Smuckers, but the other one. You have to stir it.
Oh,
you know it's
oh natural it's the natural peanut
it's,
butter.
It's the old fashioned one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The natural like oil and stuff.
I think it's Teddy.
Teddy. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Teddy.
We have a place, Publix supermarket. They actually make their own peanut butter. It's fucking good. But I like Peter Pan. Bob Gillis.
I wonder if, you know, Iggy Pop had a, you know, preference. Like, you know, Jif just smears better on my chest.
How about if he used Chunky to cut himself, too? Like, he would have killed two birds with one stone. That's a lot of rough. Hey, those chunks can be sharp. Get one stuck between your molars. I dare you.
Yeah.
Anyways. All right. So I had Iggy Pop. Who did you have? Did we go to your guy? Five.
Oh, is it my turn again?
Yeah, I said Iggy Pop. Did you say anyone after that?
So I said no. But okay. my next one, and I'm going, you know, kind of back and working my way to, you know, newer people. But you know, I would absolutely have to go with, you know, we talked about him a little bit, as Rod Stewart. It was a tremendous front man with the Jeff Beck group. With the Faces, and certainly went solo. You know, there's a guy that worked every inch of a stage, kicked, jumped, swung that microphone around.
Saw him open, you know, the Wang Center.
Yeah. Kicks soccer balls out into the audience.
Yep.
Yeah. Just he knows how to work a stage. And I do think that it's somewhat rooted in, again, the old soul stars. And whether you're talking about Jagger, Steven Tyler, Rod Stewart, it's all rooted back in James Brown, the Temptations, right. The Four Tops, all of that stuff comes to the Isley Brothers, that all comes into play. And they definitely not only leveraged a lot of influences and a lot of that kind of soul and black music, but also the swagger and the entertainment, because there were a lot of white bands that just stood in place prior to that.
So Jack, what you're in fact saying is these white men used cultural appropriation to make themselves famous. They made themselves famous on the backs of black entertainers. That's what you said.
I will say
cultural
that
cultural appropriation at its best. Reparations.
I will say that any artist uses references.
Cultural appropriation.
You can call it whatever you want.
Nope, that's what they call it today. That's what it's called. I didn't make it up.
Jesus Christ.
I didn't make it up.
You're an idiot. Fine. You want to call it cultural appropriation? Call it cultural appropriation.
Hey, I'm cracking up that Mark Smith, we're going back to peanut butter. He says, I was lucky growing up with my local store brand peanut butter with the occasional foreign object in it.
Mom, there's a Band-Aid in my peanut butter.
Band-Aid. The Band-Aid says Iggy Pop on it. What the fuck? No, yay, listen.
Rod Stewart. Bob Gillis was on. Hey, Bob.
I saw that, yeah. The unofficial mayor with him. Yeah, Rod Stewart, no doubt, buddy.
Bob Gillis, the unofficial front man of Winthrop, Massachusetts.
So I'm going to go with number six. Again, was the front man for a couple of bands, and really is one of a kind, Johnny Rotten, John Lydon. Johnny Rotten is a fucking great front man with the infamous, ha ha, ever feel like you've been cheated? And then just drops the mic and leaves. That's a great fucking Johnny Rotten, great front man.
Johnny Rotten was a great front man and very entertaining back in the day. So, as you had indicated, certainly with the Sex Pistols and then Public Image Limited
Pill. Yep.
Again, kind of carving out his own style.
Sneering, he had his own style. That's a fucking
sneering and leering at the audience
with total disdain, fucking total disdain. He would glare at them with this, like, I want to fucking kill you all. Look, total disdain for the audience. I'm sure he didn't have that, but he was great at portraying that. I'm sure he did at some audiences in the South. When they toured. So Johnny Rotten, number six. Who do you got for number six?
My number six is probably a controversial figure, and there may be people that are listening that are not fans, and I get that. People have their own thing. And I think in order to be a front man, you have to have the right mix of talent and swagger, but a lot of it comes down to ego as well. And Bono of U2.
I have him in
one of the greatest front men of all time. Not only in terms of his ability to sing, to capture an audience, to create a dynamic, but tremendous songwriter. Definitely one of the leaders of U2 in terms of taking that band into different musical directions. Certainly a mouthpiece, many times in a good way, sometimes in not such a good way. But I think that he is up there with the greats.
Yeah, I have him. I have him on my list. He was my number seven.
By the way, if you haven't listened to it, I think we talked about this last week. If you haven't gotten on Audible and listened to the new Bono memoir, it's really fucking good.
Right.
It's really good. It's not just him reading it. There's kind of a dynamic aspect to it where there's songs and he tells stories. It's really worth a listen. If you're even a passive fan, I think you'd get a lot out of it.
Audible is really good at doing stuff like that. They're really good at podcasts. They really know how to put them together. So I think I know what you're saying. Yeah, I'll check it out. Yeah, Bono, no doubt. Live Aid was the launch of U2 in a sense. Just that, doing that, the infamous when they did Bad, and it just, that just captured the world, actually. That's what I'll say. It captured the world. It was just, he did such a great job with that. He interacted, you know, he great voice, great song. And after that, he just became a legend. There's not much to say about him that everybody doesn't know. So I'm going to jump him. That was my number seven. I'm going to go to number eight. I got to go with in his day, David Lee Roth, fucking great frontman, pure rock star, fucking moron when you hear him talk, but great frontman, you know, entertaining, handsome, you know, buffed, just was like not like any other front man of his time, really.
No.
There's nobody really comparable to him, which was another reason Van Halen launched into the stratosphere. Not because of Eddie Van Halen's guitar playing, but David Lee Roth's frontmanship was a big part of launching them.
He was a great counterbalance to Eddie's creative and musical genius. He brought swagger to that band. He brought leadership to that band in terms of giving them a sound that wasn't so rooted in just heavy metal, but there was pop and soul and kind of a dance aspect to it that really came from David Lee Roth. You know, the kicks, you know, the jumps off of the platform, you know, engaging the audience. He was funny. He was entertaining.
Samurai sword.
Yeah. He never stopped moving. I mean, he was a tremendous, I remember reading back in the day in like the 80s and 90s, even Ozzy Osbourne said that there is no greater frontman in rock and roll than David Lee Roth.
Yeah. No doubt. Again, in his day, he was the quintessential frontman in that respect of rock for rock and roll. There was nobody like him. And he had fun doing it. That's one thing. That wasn't that. He enjoyed the attention. He enjoyed the entertaining. It was all about him. And that probably ended up being his downfall, too. Because his ego was much bigger than his talent. You know?
Do you want to talk a little bit about Van Halen right now? One of the things that I find a little bit disturbing that's going on in the Van Halen camp, and this has been going on for some months now, they've been trying to get their shit together to put together a tribute show or tour. And initially there was some discussion where it was going to be everybody, right? So Wolfgang Van Halen, Michael Anthony, Alex Van Halen, Sammy Hagar, even Gary Cherone and David Lee Roth. And from what I've been reading, David Lee Roth, his fragile ego just can't allow himself, even in Eddie's death, to be able to put differences aside and to honor and pay homage to somebody that really carved out a career for David Lee Roth. And most recently, I was reading an article where they had encountered or approached Joe Satriani to take the guitar responsibilities for this tribute show. But they even after Eddie's death, that band is so fucking dysfunctional that they can't get this shit together to do something to pay homage and to honor their true leader, which was Eddie.
I don't think David Lee Roth belongs on the stage anymore, period.
No, he can't sing anymore.
can't sing anymore. He can't move anymore. He comes out. He's like a fucking cartoon character. He dances like a fucking vaudevillian. He just doesn't have it anymore. And I don't think he should be out there. So I would probably be just as happy that they left it alone. And just, you know, Eddie's Eddie. There's no, you don't need to tribute him. There's no reason to do a tribute for him, I should say. Really. Just David Lee Roth just needs to just kind of, he has faded away in a sense. He tried to do a tour and really, I don't think it went well. No. People like the nostalgia acts, though, and that's what he is. That's all he is now. Who do you have for number? What's your next one? Number 7, I think.
The next one that I have, and this is more of a personal favorite, but I thought he was a great frontman, was Michael Stipe of REM.
Okay. I think Dave Phillips mentioned him earlier.
He did. He did mention him. And again, Michael Stipe was... he would dance and work the stage, probably far more than you would think that he did. He had his own thing. He had his own style, but there was a guy that could definitely command an audience and keep people engaged. Not the, split kick, jump from a platform, smear peanut butter, of some of the other guys that we had mentioned, but Michael Stipe had his own thing and led REM. And it was truly... he truly fits my description of that front man. Doesn't necessarily play an instrument. He's the one that was the liaison. He bridged the gap between the band and the audience.
Do you think, I guess you do think, Michael Stipe was a better front man than David Byrne, the Talking Heads?
I think different. I don't know that I could say one is better than the other. I think they were different.
I think David Byrne is as unique as he's not on my he's on my honorable mention list, but you can't compare the two, but I just think David Byrne is probably a more interesting frontman.
And again
theatrics, right? David Byrne had the theatrical aspect. Michael Stipe was again one of those guys just naturally moves around the stage and dances and didn't need the theatrics in a sense to do his thing. David Byrne just liked incorporating that stuff in, which is nothing wrong with it unless you sticks. So, then it's like a fucking going to see a play.
Yeah.
Wants to do that. I'll go with my number 9. And I've said this before and I'll say it again. Rock star, the late, great Scott Whelan.
Yeah.
Great front man. Great front
great,
man.
Great front man. And you know what? Underrated. A lot of people. Very.
My brother said the same thing. He said he's underrated. Yeah.
Yep. That band was dismissed, like you had indicated earlier in the show, as a Pearl Jam kind of knockoff. And they certainly weren't. I get it. They came up around the same time. And there was some similarity in terms of their vocal style in the early days. But I thought Stone Temple Pilots were super creative in terms of their songwriting approach. And Scott Weiland, or Whelan, depending upon how you want to pronounce it, to your point, man, that guy moved around the stage like a snake, like a lizard. I mean, like he had some funky moves and
absolutely.
he had a great fashion sense, and he could sing and he could be tough with the audience. He could be engaging.
Nobody worked it. Nobody worked a bullhorn better than that motherfucker. I'll tell it's you true. That. Nobody worked a bullhorn and incorporated the bullhorn into their singing like he did. I saw him twice. I saw him once. I worked the front of the stage. They played with Cheap Trick backed them up, and he came out with this fucking polyester suit on with the bell bottoms and the fucking. In like the platform shoes, just with the fucking open, open chest polyester shirt, and just fucking tore it up. And one thing that I liked about that show, that they must have done it for that particular tour. So I'm going back to 96 now. In the middle of the show, they kind of stop, And they leave the stage and the lights go out. And all of a sudden, above the stage, probably about 50 feet above the stage, something kind of starts coming down, right? And this big, round fucking stage just lowers from the ceiling. It's got fucking couches, plush chairs, cushions on the floor, fucking just, and it has some lights around it. And in the middle of the show, they did like a 5-song acoustic set just sitting on that fucking stage in the round on the front. Wasn't huge because it fit on. It was, and then that thing went up and he fucking just busted out again. It was so fucking cool to see. That was it. Yeah. And then me and Phil Kelly, he came down here and we saw them in the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Hollywood, Florida. Saw them again.
No, he definitely belongs on that list. And just because you mentioned them, you know, you can't forget about the great Robin Zander of Cheap Trick as well. Another good
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah. But played a guitar, played an instrument, right?
Back in the early days, he was primarily the lead singer.
Lead singer, yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I would put him on the list of great. He was good. He was a good front man, excellent front man. They all are. Listen, if you're the front man of a rock band, Jack Calabrese and Scott McLean don't make you or break you by putting you on or off our list. They're all great because they made it, right? So you got to give them that. Each one was unique in their own way.
Sure, sure.
And there's levels. There's levels. Like Peter Wolfe is on, and he's not on the, I wouldn't put him in the top level, but I'd put him on level 2, which is not a bad thing. Level 2 in this category is not a bad thing.
Outside of New England,
nobody knows who he is.
Peter Wolfe is a great front man, but he's not Mick Jagger. He's not Freddie Mercury.
Right. He's not in the first tier. I mean, the top tier could be 20. He might be 21. So I get number 9, Scott Weiland, however you want to pronounce it. And he fronted Velvet Revolver, too.
Yeah, he sure did.
You know? And, I mean, all you have to do is watch those videos, Slither and Fall to Pieces, and you can see how fucking great he was. Unfortunately, he passed in a very... I guess it is a rock and roll way, you know, in a fucking trailer, I think, right?
Way too
Something
young.
Like that. Yeah, way too young. But he was headed down that path, man. Some of these dudes, they couldn't get off the train. You know, that was it. He was destined. He had drug problems his whole life, they seemed, his whole career. I mean, he cost them a lot of money. Because of his drug habit. He cost that band a lot of money. But, all right, what do you got?
I have a couple that are all kind of bunched up. But the one of them that I definitely have to bring up, just a personal favorite, is Eddie Vedder. Which is a nice segue going from Stone Temple Pilots to, you know, Pearl Jam. But Eddie Vedder... you know, consummate lead singer, you know, again, can capture and hold an audience, you know, dramatic, great voice, you know, especially live. He's
intense,
got his thing.
Very intense.
He's got his thing where he can be very, very intense and really get into, you know, a song. I love the fact that they don't do their set list until like an hour before the show. So the band doesn't really know what they're going to play. You know, he's the one that leads them in, and he comes out. If you've ever seen Pearl Jam in concert, he'll walk out with either a notebook or a little suitcase or a bunch of cardboard under his arm where he actually lays it out, where he literally has some of the words handwritten in front of him. The other thing that I think is cool is that not afraid to play covers, you know, especially of his heroes, whether it's Iggy Pop or whether it's, The Who, you know, he's a big Who fan, or the Dead Boys. I love that every show he's always got a bottle of wine. I think in his rider, when they go out on tour, that he has to have, you know, 3 or 4 bottles of like top shelf Barolo wine, and he'll kill a bottle of wine up on stage. You know,
that's toward what the Mark end of the Smith show when said.
they're
Mark Smith has said, in the ever-present bottle of wine.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, almost at the end of almost every show when they do a live, he comes out with the, you know, the tambourines and he's chucking them out in the audience. When I saw him at Fenway, one of the cool things that he did was he ran out to the front of the stage. So he's in Fenway Park. And I know he did the same thing that he was at when he was at Wrigley. And he had a baseball glove. He had his baseball glove in a ball and he was throwing it into the audience. And he was literally playing catch. Nice. With people at Fenway cool. Park, which was kind of cool. Eddie Vedder is a great front man. You know, used to do the whole, you know, climbing up the scaffolding and falling into the crowd and stage diving and all that
and
stuff.
And then they get old. Bono used to do that too.
Yeah, he doesn't do a lot of that type of jumping anymore. But
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, if you've never seen Pearl Jam live, you will find Eddie Vedder mesmerizing.
Yeah, I've seen them, yeah. Me and Phil Kelly, I believe, saw them
when Phil Kelly would have made a great front man.
No, Phil's a great wingman. There was no better wingman than Phil Kelly. Jim Hurley's a good wingman, but Phil's a great wingman, too. Phil doesn't want the attention. Phil is always the guy push you to the front. He just likes being... calling the shots from behind the scenes, pulling the strings. I have a quick list. I want to get this over because I know you probably want to go by now. And there's actually one thing I wanted to touch on. So give me another like 10 minutes. But
you got it, dude. I'm not in any rush.
My short list of honorable mentions. Don't dispute Steve Perry. Right?
Nope.
Steve Perry's a great front man. Maynard, right? Maynard's a great front man from Tool. Pete Steele from Typo Negative. I don't know if you're into them, but Pete Steele, he passed away, but he was a fucking ominous front man. Like, dude was just fucking ominous, right? Presence. He was all about presence in that deep, what do you call it, baritone type voice. Great front man, Perry Farrell. Great front man.
Sure. Yep.
I don't like them, but Anthony Kiedis from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, great front man. Talk about someone that doesn't stop moving. I'm not a big fan, but Anthony Kiedis, would you say? Yeah, no?
Yeah, Anthony Kiedis is definitely a good front man.
And Michael Hutchins.
Fantastic front man.
There's certain front men that when they died, the band died, right? And that tells you how great they were, how much they meant to that band. One would be INXS. The other would be Stone Temple Pilots. The Doors. When Morrison died, the Doors couldn't, they never bounced back from that. Like they couldn't get anybody to replace him, right? Yeah, so that shows you how great they were. And then I'll say for females, my girl, Courtney Love, fucking great front woman.
Sure.
Courtney Love was fucking crazy, but she put on a great show. So that's my short list. You know, that we could go on and on. And Dave Phillips says Rob Thomas. Fuck Rob Thomas. Matchbox 32, whatever the fuck they are. Fuck them.
Well, so, you can't forget Debbie Harry.
No, hey, right. Debbie Harry. But Courtney Love was Debbie Harry was just nice to look at, great voice, but not really like a, you know, she stood out because she was with an all-male band, but she was no Chrissy Hynde, right? Chrissy Hynde is a great frontman, but she played the guitar, so that would probably eliminate her from, but so did Courtney Love at times.
Yeah.
But not all the time. I wanted to get to this audit. Do you have any? Do you have a list of honorable mentions that you might have had?
Oh my extras? God! I have a bunch. How about it's Ian just, Asbury? Ian Asbury from
Ian Asbury the from the Cult. Saw them twice. Yeah, with, fucking great.
Or Chris Robinson from the Black Crowes.
I mentioned him to my brother today. Yeah,
was Chris Robinson. Absolutely tremendous. Chester Bennett from Linkin Park.
Move closer to your mic.
Chester Bennett from Linkin Park.
God rest his soul.
Was in a, was another, you know, another great, great front man.
Yeah. So I want to get your opinion on this. Let me open this up. So last week we talked about ticket prices, correct? Mm-hmm. And one of the groups we talked about was Metallica. So they did a show down here in Hollywood. It was like a one-off type thing, and $2,000, $3,000 for tickets people were paying. And they did that, what do you call it, premium pricing? Is that what it is?
So they have their platinum and what they call dynamic pricing.
Dynamic pricing. Okay, so, you know, we kind of, you know, kicked the shit out of Bruce Springsteen and Metallica. So then I read this article. It says, some Metallica ticket packages will cost serious money. I'm going to kind of read this. So Metallica recently announced a new album, 72 Seasons, and a special world tour, which features a quote. I know, you know, this is bullshit. You, Jack, know this is fucking bullshit. Which features a, quote, no repeat weekend that will see the band play two entirely different sets and feature different support acts on each date, right? Starting in April of 2023, we'll be visiting 22 different cities around the world and playing two nights in each city, with each no repeat weekend show a completely unique experience, two totally different set lists, with two different bands opening the show each night. And that's what Metallica put on their website, right? Purchase a two-day ticket, and you won't see the same song twice, for a total of over 30 songs spanning 40-plus years of being lucky enough to make music. Most of the shows will be on Fridays and Sundays, so we'll be sure to have lots of extracurricular events for you to hang out, to hang with fellow Metallica fans at before the show kickoffs and on Saturday night in between. Now, what will these tickets cost Metallica fans? Well, if you want the Nothing Else Matters Snake Pit experience, it'll cost you $3,222 to $4,398, which gets you access to the Snake Pit and also a chance to meet two members of the band. It also includes numerous goodies and a production tour from a Metallica roadie, right? But wait, there's more. The Lux Eterna platform package goes for $7,272 or $909 a person. It allows up to eight people access to a private viewing booth no further than 75 feet from the stage for both nights at the same city. The platform will have a cooler full of beer and soda and access to the official, quote, black box pre-show lounge, where you can get three free drinks and appetizers or snacks. One free piece of merch for everyone in the group. Now, Metallica is also offering a, quote, I Disappear tickets, which allows you access to every single show on both continents of their tour for 2 years. That costs $3,498, which seems like a steal, right? Seems fucking like a big, that's shit. All two continents. But you do have to pay for your plane tickets, your food, your lodging. So add that all in, right? The least expensive package is the Frantic Early Entry Package, which goes for $414 to $598 per ticket, which offers one general admission floor ticket with early entry to both shows in the same city, one limited edition piece of merch. That could be a fucking press pass. It could be anything, right? A bandolier, whatever they call them. One complimentary drink before doors open. A priority area for purchasing merch. Like, we're going to let you pay $80 for a t-shirt first, right? Prior to the doors opening, and on-site perks like priority check-in, a dedicated support staff, and fast track into the venue. I could go on, but this is thievery at its best. Now, you yourself have told me you've seen our boy Dave Matthews, and I liked Dave Matthews, so I could say our boy Dave Matthews. How many times it didn't see the same fucking song twice? Four times, five times, right? The Grateful Dead, which Mark Smith is a fucking fan of, and I don't understand that. But they could play 7 concerts, 8 concerts, 9 concerts, and not play the same song twice. Pearl Jam, you said, played 2 nights and didn't play the same song twice. They didn't charge $4,000 a ticket.
No, right? look, let's face it.
Oh.
The top echelon rock acts, and it's not just rock acts, right? But the top acts that are out there right now, they're just blatantly raping their fans. You know, I mean,
Mark Smith.
Metallica, you know, will try to justify it, you know, by saying, well, you know, we're giving you a different experience. I mean, there is a difference between what we talked about with the Springsteen thing and Metallica. Metallica, you're talking about different packages that have backstage tours and all that stuff. The Springsteen thing, you're just talking about an average, you know, ticket to go to a show. But here's the thing that has to change. And I don't know how you do this or if you can do this, but the only way that these bands are going to stop this bullshit is if we fucking stop buying the tickets.
I agree. You get no argument any way you can solve this, but it's not going to be solved because it's the fucking new thing and it's here to stay. That's what these bands are going to do.
You are going to have somebody that's going to pay the, you know, $2,000, $4,000, $7,000 that's going to walk out of that and say, you know what? For me, it was worth it. I just don't. Concerts used to be a nice, inexpensive way to, you know, get some entertainment and to see, you know, some bands. And I get it. You know, the productions that bands put on now are far more elaborate.
Doesn't matter.
With the explosions and lasers and, you know, screens and that type of thing. But what's the tipping point? I mean, exactly. You know, the thing that disgusted me about the Springsteen thing is he blatantly said, yeah, you know,
if they don't like it, they can get their money back on the way out.
We're charging people, and yeah, it is what it is. I make no apologies for it. Well, you know what? You're worth $800 million or whatnot. Go fuck yourself. And by the way, here's the big thing. Metallica, Springsteen, you know, you could throw the Who in there and whatnot. These are bands that are a shadow of their former selves. You're not seeing them at their peak.
No.
You know, and you know what? You know for a fact that if you're charging people that type of money to go to your show, the production team is going to ensure that the band is going to look and sound good. So a lot of it is going to be pre-programmed. You're going to have people playing behind the stage to make the band sound fuller and more on. You're going to have backup singers that are going to be hitting the high notes. It's all fucking smoke and mirrors.
Yeah. So Mark Smith,
we got to get to that point. When is that tipping point going to happen where people are going to say, you fucking crazy?
Yeah. So Mark Smith, he messaged in. So it looks like to have a good concert experience, a fan has to take out a second mortgage. One of these ticket prices is my mortgage. It's not the low end.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's like, hey, baby, we're going to take a mortgage payment and I'm going to go see Metallica because it's one ticket. One ticket for two, but I'm seeing them for 2 nights, baby. You know? Yeah, no. And,
Bear in mind that you know these bands are and these artists are charging this type of money, knowing that we're either in or heading into a recession.
That's a great point. That's a fucking great point. To finish what Mark Smith said, he says, "I saw a Porcupine Tree from 16th row with my son for $100 a ticket and had a magical night. I'm done." Then Perry Dinovich says, $100 a song? Fuck that noise!" Right. And Dean Farron says $90 per ticket to see Tool. Nosebleed in the arena, but I was not disappointed. See, that's reasonable nowadays. It was unheard of 10 years ago, but it's reasonable nowadays.
The best solution to all of this for everybody that's involved is to say bye-bye Metallica, you know, bye-bye Pearl Jam, who charged a lot of money, you know, in their last tour. Bye bye Springsteen. And if you could actually take the risk and start and going to see smaller more bands. Local yeah. bands. You'll pay a lot less money. You'll benefit people in your local community. You'll hear some great music, and you'll help bands that are on the rise instead of supporting an already overblown lifestyle.
Yes, that are already, you know, fucking half a billionaires, you know, with fucking what they're worth. Like, they don't need the money, so why? It's just that it's the thing to do. They know that there's a section of the demographic that they're aiming at that has disposable income, that wants to be elite, because, not to get political, but elitism is a thing in the fucking United States now, and it's becoming pretty obvious. This is elitism right there. That's like, only the people with really good money can come and see us. And if you're, if you're lucky enough to save your pennies, you'll see a special show, you know? That's what it is.
Yeah. They're
fucking elitists.
Look, not for nothing. I saw Metallica 4 or 5 months ago. You know, they headlined at Boston Calling. And you know what? They were okay. They're not like they were when I saw them in the 90s or the 80s.
Right. I told you, I saw them in 97 in Albuquerque. Korn backed them up. That was the first time I saw Korn. And that was 97. That's 20-something years ago. They can't be any better than they were then.
They're not.
You know what I mean?
They're not.
I think they can't be any better than when I saw them. And that's why, Jack, I'll see bands once a lot. Like I've always said, I very rarely, there's a handful of bands that I've seen more than once. If I see a great show, I'm fucking happy. I'm happy with that. I can fucking walk away and say, I saw a great show. You know,
how much would you pay to see Blur?
I think we talked about that last week. I would probably
a little bit.
I would probably pay a couple hundred for a ticket.
Yeah, the only reason I mentioned it is
you're not probably going to see them again.
So. Yeah, the only reason I mentioned it is they played off the Wembley show that they're doing as a one off, but now they're actually headlining a festival in Spain. And I think
they won't do a tour. I don't think Damon Albarn will do a tour.
I will bet you that they do a handful of dates in the States. Summer.
Well, then we'll meet somewhere, because I would love to see Blur. Because I'll see Blur before Oasis ever gets back together.
Oasis will get back together.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
All right, buddy. Get off. I'm gonna jump into the top 10 this week and music in this day, and then birthdays, and then I'll be out too. So, my friend, always good talking to you. Great show.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Talk to you soon.
I'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're a great front man, by the way.
I know that. I'm like David Lee Roth. I know this. You don't have to tell me. I'm already
big, giant, loudmouth.
I'm a badass 59-year-old. That's what I am, motherfucker. All right, get off my show. He's gone. I kicked him off before he could. See, Jack has this thing that he's done to me a couple times. It's like he'll be like, hey, and then he'll cut himself out. You know, I've done that to people. I've made phone calls. Like, I'll call somebody, and I'll be like, and then it'll be a recording. Like, you know, leave a message, and I'll go, dude, you're not going to fucking believe this. I really need to talk to you. You know, I was in my car and I was driving and dude, all of a sudden, and then I'll hang up. Just leave them hanging. Yeah. It's actually pretty, I know it's childish, but like I always say, sometimes I act like I'm 12. It's fun. Let's get into the top 10 this week. Top 10 this week in 2000. Anything after 2000 starts to get a little sketchy to me. Like, I don't know. I kind of, this is kind of stretchy, but you know, you can see the change in music. Number 10 this week in 2000 was Shape of My Heart by the Backstreet Boys. See, right off the bat, that tells you what that was all about, what 2000 was all about. Number 9 this week in 2000, The Way You Love Me by Faith Hill. Easy to look at. easy to look at, especially back then. Still a good-looking older woman. Number 8 this week in 2000, Most Girls by Pink. I was never a fan. And I don't think Pink's that good looking. I think she looks mannish. Looks mannish to me. I think she's overrated in the looks department. But that's me. Number 7 this week in 2000, It Wasn't Me by Shaggy featuring Ricardo Rick Rock Ducent. It wasn't me. Did you do it in the shower? It wasn't me. Did you do it in the bathroom? It wasn't me. You know the song. You know the song. See, I sing every show. But number 6 this week in 2000, This I Promise You by NSYNC. I actually like this song. This song really doesn't get played a lot. It got played a lot back in 2000, in the early 2000s, but it didn't really, I don't know. I think it should be played more. Number 10 this week in 2000, I mean, number 5 this week, Kryptonite by Three Doors Down. That's a good song. That's a good, Three Doors Down kind of hung in there for a minute, right? Then, Creed and all those other early 2000s bands, they kind of faded off. Number 4 this week in 2000 is Gotta Tell You by Samantha Mumba. Number 3 this week in 2000, with Arms Wide Open, like I just said, Creed, there you go. Scott Sapp, though, he was the problem with that band. Scott Sapp, I think Creed was from Boston or Massachusetts, I think. His ego got the best of him way too early. And that was the end of that band. I think he tried to go solo and, you know, a big... He was kind of an asshole, too. Thought he was all that. He ain't all that. Fuck Scott Sapp. Whatever. All right. This week, number 2 this week in 2000, Case of the X, What You Gonna Do by Maya. And number 1 this week in 2000, Independent Woman Part 1 by Destiny's Child. Soon to become just Beyonce without Destiny's Child. All right, let's move on. This Day in Music. I'm going to go backwards. Let's see. There's a lot that happened. Jesus Christ. He had nothing to do with it. On this day in 1964, Beach Boy Brian Wilson married Marilyn Ravel in L.A. The couple divorced in 1979. Marilyn and her sister and cousin were in a group called The Honeys, who were produced by Brian Wilson. Marilyn and Brian had 2 daughters. If Jack was here, I'd ask him, can you guess who those 2 daughters are? Marilyn and Brian Wilson had 2 daughters who were Carney and Wendy Wilson, who became members of Wilson Phillips. Now you know. On this day in 1967, the Beatles' Apple Boutique on 94 Baker Street in London opened its doors. The store closed 7 months later when it fell foul to council objections over the psychedelic mural painted on the outside of the building. All the goods from the shop, check this shit out. Imagine walking down the street one day, you're walking by the Apple Boutique, and shit, they just start giving shit away. Hey, you want this signed John Lennon fucking t-shirt? Yeah, they gave all the shit away for free to passersby and people who had queued them throughout the night for a chance to get a free item. Just handed the shit out. How fucking cool is that? On this day in 1967, Otis Redding went into the studio to record Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. The song went on to be his biggest hit. Redding didn't get to see its release. He was killed 3 days later, unfortunately, in a plane crash. Now, I always ask this question. Where did Otis Redding write that song? Right? People always say, oh, San Francisco. Well, they think it's San Francisco because it's about the San Francisco Bay, right? Actually, Redding wrote the first verse of the song under the abbreviated title Dock of the Bay on a houseboat at Waldo Point in Sausalito, California, which is right across the bay. I got a quick story about that, actually. A short time after his appearance at the Monterey Pop Festival, Redding's familiar whistling heard before the songs fade was the singer just fooling around. It's kind of riffing. He had intended to return to the studio at a later date to add words in place of the whistling. Now you know. That's a great did you know. Now back to Sausalito. So I went and visited a friend of mine who has since passed in San Francisco, friend Mike Harwell. And he lived on the Bayside, you know, in San Francisco. And he took my wife and I, my then wife, over to Sausalito to cross the bridge. And I fucking fell in love with that place. Sausalito is a fucking cool place, right? I actually liked it so much, I told him to take us back. We went back twice. So I had always said, so we're going back to early 2000s with this. And I had always said, if I could ever live anywhere in the United States, and I had a choice, I would live in Sausalito, California. It's just a fucking cool town, right? So fast forward. My now wife and I decide we're going to buy a house. And we buy a house here in Boca. And the house is on Sausalito Drive. So maybe when I said if I could live anywhere, it would be in Sausalito, I should have been a little more specific. But I do. I live on Sausalito Drive. So there you go. Don't anybody come to my house. You got to get past the guard. So that's just a warning. And he's armed. So none of you crazy fans, stalkers, don't be stalking me. Because Milk Crates and Turntables is that popular. Anyways, on this day in 1968, the Beatles' White Album started a 7-week run at number one on the UK chart. The double set was the first on Apple label. Yeah. On this day in 1974, I think if you're a baby boomer, you know this. Carl Douglas started a 2-week run at number one on the U.S. singles charts with, you guessed it, Kung Fu Fighting. The song was recorded in 10 minutes. No shit. No shit. Really? I mean, that's a pretty intricate song. I thought they at least took 10 days, 10 hours. No, 10 minutes. And it started out as a B-side. It went on to sell over 10 million copies. Oh, my God. I listened to it. So, but then again, I was fucking 10. So on this day in 1974, Barry White was at number one in the UK singles charts with You're the First, the Last, My Everything. Sounds like him. Singer's first UK number one, originally written in the 1950s as a country song with the title You're My First, You're My Last, My In-Between. On this day in 1976, the Eagles released New Kid in Town. Not a big fan of that song, which became the group's third U.S. number one in February the following year. The single, written by Don Henley, Glenn Frey, and J.D. Salter, was released as the first single from their fifth album, Hotel California. On this day in 1977, inventor Dr. Peter Carl Goldmark was killed in a car crash at the age of 71. Do you know what Dr. Peter Carl Goldmark invented? I don't think you'd get it. Dr. Goldmark invented the long-playing micro-groove record in 1945, the LP. They went on to revolutionize the way people listen to music. The LP. Look at that. Let me see. Killed in a car crash, too. Well, he's 71. I guess. I don't know. On this day in 1979, the Police had their second UK number one single with Walking on the Moon, taken from their second album, Regatta de Blanc. The video for the song was filmed at Kennedy Space Center, interspersed with NASA footage. On this day in 1985, Mr. started a 2-week run at number one with Take These Broken Wings and Baby Fly Away. Yes. Okay, you get it. On this day in 1991, U2 went to number one in the U.S. album charts with Octung Baby. That might not be, if they released that today, I bet you they would probably, the woke crowd would try to cancel them. You can't say Octung. You kidding me? Change the name. Cancel U2, featuring the song One, great song, Zoo Station, The Fly, and Even Better Than The Real Thing. Yeah, all good songs. On this day in 1991, George Michael and Elton John were at number one in the UK with a live version of Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me, a hit for Elton in 1974. All proceeds from the hit went to AIDS charities. On this day in 1992, I'm getting congested here. Jesus. This day in 1992, Mariah Carey's MTV Unplugged EP became the first Sony mini disc to be released in the U.S. That's kind of an unforgettable Unplugged, I think. On this day in 1993, Manic Street Preachers co-manager Philip Hall died from cancer. Hall was a former Record Mirror journalist and had also worked in PR for Stiff Records. He represented many acts, including the Stone Roses, the Pogues, James, the Waterboys, the Beautiful South, and Radiohead. All good bands. I never heard of Beautiful South. On this day in 2003, Britney Spears was at number one on the U.S. album charts with In the Zone, the singer's fourth U.S. number one album. I'll tell you what. Saw a video of her the other day. That girl might be crazier than a sprayed roach, but she still looks fucking good. Just saying. She still looks good. I mean, I'd never put up with Cray Cray, but sometimes you got to think about it. Britney still looks good. Just saying. Cray Cray. On this day in 2005, the MBE medal that John Lennon returned to the Queen was found in a royal vault. At MBE is some British title. Was found in a royal vault at St. James Palace. Lennon returned his medal in November of 1969 with a letter accompanying it saying, quote, Your Majesty, I am returning my MBE as a protest against Britain's involvement in the Nigeria Biafra thing, called it a thing, against our support of America and Vietnam, and against cold turkey slipping down the record charts. With love, John Lennon. Historians are calling for the medal to be put on public display. On this day in 2014, Pink Floyd's classic album, Dark Side of the Moon, made a surprise return to the Billboard chart when it landed at number 13, thanks to the ultra-cheap pricing in the Google Play Store, where the album was discounted to 99 cents. Oh, Lord. Although it held the number one spot for the U.S. for only 1 week, when released in 1973, it remained on the Billboard charts 741 weeks. On this day in 2015, David Bowie made his last public appearance when he attended the opening night of the Lazarus production at the New York Theater Workshop in Manhattan. Tickets to the entire run of the musical, which ran until January 20th, 2016, sold out within hours of being made available. The documentary on Bowie where they show him going to the rehearsals. He didn't look good. This one goes out to my buddy Mark Smith from the Music Relics podcast. Also of the Music Relics podcast, Perry Dedovich and Lou Colicchio. But I'll talk to Mark on this one. And I think he might know this already. It's not a happy story, but on this day in 2016, Greg Lake, who fronted both King Crimson and Emerson, Lake & Palmer, died at age 69 after a battle with cancer. One of the founding fathers of progressive rock, the band combined heavy rock riffs with a classical influence. They scored hit albums with Pictures at an Exhibition, Trilogy, and Brain Salad Surgery. And Lake had his solo hit in I Believe in Father Christmas, which is maybe my favorite Christmas song. It's definitely in the top three favorite Christmas songs of all time. That is a very underrated Christmas song. I Believe in Father Christmas. One of the greatest voices of rock, my buddy Mark Smith. Yes, he was. Yes, he was. Jimi Hendrix considered joining ELP in their early incarnation. I didn't know this. In their earliest incarnation. And if this had happened, the band would have been known as Help. Hendrix, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. Look at that. That's, I guess that's real. That's real. That's interesting. Did you know that, Mark Smith? I bet you didn't. I bet you Perry Denovich knew it, though. And Lou, because Lou has that in his notebook. The Lou Colicchio notebook, the infamous notebook. Hey, Mark Smith, I want to know, since you're watching, have you put any notes in that gigantic notebook that you bought to compete with the Lou Colicchio, what do you call it, novel? Let's see. On this day in 2019, Ozzy Osbourne offered $25,000 as a reward. I have 13F. Okay. Glory, 13 glorious pages. Mark Smith's getting there. He's getting there. You guys will be on again soon. I kind of miss you guys. On this day in 2019, Ozzy Osbourne offered $25,000 as a reward for the return of stolen instruments previously owned by his late guitarist Randy Rhoads after the Messina School of Music in North Hollywood was robbed on Thanksgiving night. The stolen instruments included Rhoads' first electric guitar, a 1963 Harmony Rocket, as well as a rare Marshall prototype made specifically for Rhoads. I would assume those are probably in a private collection by then. Probably went right into a private collection. And on this day in 2021, Scottish singer-songwriter Steve Bronski died from smoke inhalation in a fire at his home in Soho, London at age 61. He was a co-founder and keyboard player of the group Bronski Beat, known for the singles Small Town Boy and Why. He was also well known as an LGBT activist and was openly gay himself from an early age. That's what the song Small Town Boy is about. I believe Jimmy Somerville is the lead singer for Bronski Beat. That's a great song. Small Town Boy is one of my favorite 80s songs. It's a great song. The video, it's kind of a sad song, though, in its own way. You'll watch it. Watch the video, Small Town Boy. Jimmy Somerville's got a great, great voice. He went on to sing with the Communards also. Great voice. Great entertainer. They had gone, Bronski Beat was coming on tour. They went on tour and they were coming into the United States and they got refused by customs. They got refused by customs to enter the country because the band demanded to be strip searched. Now that's an angle. And they were so adamant about being strip searched, U.S. Customs says, you know what? You're not coming in. No. You want to fuck around? Now you're not coming in the country. And they refused them entry into the country. So this is a little known fact about Bronski Beat. I actually like Bronski Beat. Now, about winding it up now. We're about winding it up. Born today. Born on this day, December 7th, 1942. Harry Chapin. Singer-songwriter. 1974 UK number 34 single, WOLD, and 1974 US number one single, Cats in the Cradle. I fucking hate that song. I've said this before. If you like that song, fucking slit your wrists. If that song doesn't depress you, then you're a fucking sociopath. And why do you want to listen to a song that fucking depresses you? Makes you feel bad or sad. What the fuck? It's a great song. No, it's fucking makes you just want to hurt yourself. I don't know. Not me. I don't want to hurt myself. I'm just saying. That's why I don't listen to the song. Taxi is a great song too. Taxi, and then the part two to that. But Taxi is a great song. I mean, Harry Chapin was a Perry Dinovich, Pearl Harbor. Yeah. Well, Harry Chapin, Pearl Harbor, both depressing. What does Pearl Harbor and Harry Chapin have in common? They're both fucking depressing. Yeah, Neither one of them are happy. No happy thoughts there. No. Cats in the Cradle. No happy thoughts there. So, anyways. Great songwriter. Great songwriter. On this day, born on this day in 1949, as Jack and I spoke about earlier, Tom Waits. I don't have to go into him. And finally, born on this day in 1958, for all you 80s rockers, for all you 80s, I should say, new wavers, Tim Butler, bassist with English rock band The Psychedelic Furs, which I say is one of the greatest names in music history. Fucking Psychedelic Furs is one of the greatest names in music history. I just think so. It's a great name, man. Film director John Hughes used the song Pretty in Pink for his 1986 movie of the same name. And that's it. That's it, people. Podcast number 82 in the books. 82. Like I said, soon enough, before Christmas, which is coming up fast, I'm going to have my buddies from the Music Relish podcast come on. Maybe we could get, again, I think he's a bot. Perry Dedovich, I think, is a bot. I don't think he's a real person. I know Mark Smith is. I know Lou Colicchio is. They're real people, but I don't know about Perry. But maybe we'll get him on. Maybe not. If not, Mark Smith and Luke Colicchio will be on soon enough, maybe next week. Maybe I'll bring them on with Jack, and he can piss them off again. No, I don't think he does that, but I don't know. Jack has a way of doing that, though, doesn't he? Just ask me. Anyways, all right, people, thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your views. If you like it, share it. If you're watching this on YouTube for the first time, hit the subscribe button, hit the alert bell. It'll tell you when we come on, but we usually come on Wednesday nights live. And like I always say, you are the engine that runs this machine. Without you, I guess it would just be me talking to myself, which I am doing right now. And that's fine. And as I always say in the end, doing this show for you, to quote my favorite artist, Morrissey, the pleasure, the privilege is mine. I will be back next Wednesday night. Maybe with a crew of people. Maybe it'd be a lively show. Who knows? It always is. All right, guys. Thanks. And girls, thanks for watching and listening.